1987, and this is Ted Brown interviewing, talking with John C. Baylor Jr. at Urbana, Illinois, in John's office in the chemistry department. John, I know that, I think I know that you were born in Colorado in 1904.
Right.
Was your birthday May 27th?
That's right, yes.
So yesterday was your birthday.
Yes, 87 years old yesterday.
83.
Let's not rush it. Yeah.
Well, I don't know a great deal about your parents and your family. Would you tell us a little bit?
Well, yes. My father was born in Illinois, actually, at Mason City, or near Mason City, where his father was, I guess he was in charge of the county pool. And when father was 2 years old, they moved to eastern Kansas. And then a few years later, there was a drought in Kansas, the crops failed, so they said they'd move on and they went to Colorado. And my grandfather had a, what we would now call a trucking business. He hauled supplies to mines in Leadville, and so father spent some years in Leadville. In fact, he was the first graduate of Leadville High School in 1883. Actually, there were three members of the class, but his name was first in the alphabet, so he got his diploma first, and is on the roll of the high school as graduate number one. And then a few years later, he moved to Glenwood Springs, where he worked on his father's farm, and where he met my mother. My mother was born in Pennsylvania, but about 1890, her whole family moved to eastern Colorado, and she went to school at Greeley, which is now called Northern Colorado University. In those days, it was called the Greeley Normal School. And she went to teach in Glenwood Springs, and that's where my parents met. They were married in 1897, and through some reading that they did, the book, name I've forgotten at the moment, they got the idea that it would be great to go to college. And my mother figured that if they saved their money real hard for 4 years, then they could go to college. And father agreed to this, and this was long in the late summer or very early fall, and they kept thinking about it and talking about it, and then mother came to the mother, we worked real hard and saved the money for 2 years, then go to college for 2 years, and then we get to drop out and earn some more money and go back and graduate. See, my father was already 32 years old,
mm-hmm.
and mother was 25. Well, it happened, I don't know just why. Father was in town in Glenwood Springs one day, along about Christmas, and he overheard a man say to someone else, well, the second semester of the university starts next week. So he went home, recounted this to my mother, and she said, well, someday we'll be there. And he said, we're going now. So they had no money, but they packed up their stuff and went to Boulder and enrolled in the university. Now, this was a remarkable thing because at that time, the university had only about 300 students. It was a new school. And for a man 32 and married and his wife to enroll at the university would be something. And they both got jobs. My father was had a job in the chemistry storeroom. And my mother was secretary to the dean. Of course, in those days they didn't have typewriters. I guess she just did all the secretary and the pen thing. But anyway, they borrowed some money too, and they graduated in 3.5 years. And mother finished a little early. She didn't get her diploma, but she did some high school teaching the last semester of last year. And father stayed on Boulder and got his bachelor's degree. then they went to Cripple Creek, where Father had a job teaching in the high school. I stayed there, I think, only 2 years. My older sister was born in Cripple Creek. But while they were in Boulder, Father's working in the storeroom, and of course he majored in chemistry, he came into contact with a man named Palmer, who was a professor of chemistry. Well, just about the time they graduated, Professor Palmer made president of the School of Mines. And he needed a chemistry teacher, and he remembered my father. So he asked him to come to the School of Mines as a assistant professor of chemistry. So 5 years from the time my father was a laboring man on his father's farm, he was a college professor. And he stayed at the School of Mines for 15, 16 years. And then he went to work in the research laboratory of the Great Western Sugar Company, where he stayed until he retired some years later. And that's a quick survey.
So how old were you? Was your father when you were born then? He must
have been. He was 39 years old.
Oh, late 30s.
Yeah. You see, they, father and mother were married 5 years before they had any children.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, they were not having children while they were going to school.
Yes.
And then I was born 2 years later after that, yes. Father was 39, mother was 32 when I was born.
Well, then you grew up largely in Golden.
Yes, yes. I stayed in Golden until I went to the university.
Mm-hmm. Well, during that time of growing up in Golden, who had the most influence on you in terms of your own decisions about what kind of a career you were going to have or whether you'd go to college or whatever?
There was never any question in my mind that I would go to college. Of course, my mother and father had been so eager to go to college, so sold on the idea that just taken for granted that the children would go to college. And I don't think any of my school teachers had any great influence. Well, all of them had some influence, of course, but none stand out as being the real top-notch teachers. Well, my teacher of Latin in high school was perhaps the best teacher I had. But I wouldn't say he had any influence on my long-term career. But my parents spent a great deal of time with me and with my sisters.
You had two sisters?
Yes, an older sister and a younger sister. And yes, when I was even a very small boy, I used to go to my father's laboratory and, quote, help, unquote, him in his chemical work. He was always doing some research, and I could help him filter things or wash dishes or one thing or another. So I became acquainted with chemistry before I ever went to school. And I remember one incident. I saw a bottle in his laboratory labeled H2O2. And I asked him, well, why don't they just say H-O? And he explained to me why it was H2O2 rather than H-O.
Mm.
And I'm sure I was not able to read at that time.
That was a pretty acute question for someone.
Well, but you see, yes, but I knew some chemistry.
Yes, you must have.
Yeah, he was a fine teacher. In fact, he had several years later, he received a certificate from the state of Colorado for eminence in teaching. And but we frequently, almost every Sunday afternoon, for example, my father and I would go for a walk, and we'd talk about this and this and so on, not only chemical things, but just all sorts of things. And so he spent a great deal of time with me, and I spent quite a lot of time with my mother, too. I remember when I was in high school, I entered high school very young, I was only 12 years old, and I'll tell you about that later. But in my sophomore year, we read in our English class Emerson's essay. Well, Emerson's essay is pretty stuck for a kid 13 years old.
Yes.
And so my mother, while she was ironing, I remember, I would read Emerson's essay. I'd read a sentence and I'd say, what does that mean? And she'd explain to me, and read on, and I'd say, what does that mean? Well, I think now, if I read him his essays, I would find them very stimulating, very worthwhile. At that time, without her help, I could never have understood it at all. But my parents had a tremendous influence on me. They didn't try to guide me in choice of a profession. I meet people who say, well, I knew when I was 6 years old I wanted to be a chemist or a doctor or whatnot. I didn't have that experience. Even when I started college, I wasn't sure I was going to be a chemist. I took the course in chemistry and I did well in it and I rather liked it. Professor Eckley was a good teacher, and the next fall I'd take another course in chemistry. Pretty soon I discovered that I was majoring in chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
But
you didn't feel there was any particular pressure from your parents to go in that direction?
Oh, no, none at all. No. In fact, I remember one occasion my father talking with me about what profession I would follow. I don't think chemistry entered into it at all. It was a matter of whether I would be a teacher or do something else. He said, well, you know, teaching isn't a bad profession. That's all I remember about that. But when I was a junior in college, I was in the dean's office one day. Now, the dean had been, it was the same dean that had been the dean when my parents were in the same school. And he called me into his office and asked me, what are you going to do when you graduate? I just don't know yet. I haven't decided. And he gave me quite a little talk about how I should be a teacher. And the only people who are really happy are teachers. Well, I don't know that that's true. But I remember that conversation very well. I think the time I started to graduate school, I had decided I would be a teacher.
But your choice of chemistry, was that influenced, do you think, by any particular teacher that you had at school there? Any one of the faculty members who particularly...
No. I don't think so. As I said, Professor Eckley, who gave the lectures in general chemistry and organic, which I took as a sophomore, he was a very good teacher. But whether that influenced me to become a chemist, I don't know. It might have, but I doubt it, really. I think it was the fact that my father was a chemist and a good teacher that had the biggest influence on me.
Okay, we can keep going. So you then decided you were going to say a word that you passed up there about the fact that you began high school at such an early age. Was that because you were tutored at home?
This was, I think, a disciplinary measure. When I was in the fifth grade, the teacher complained to my father that I didn't pay attention. I was always just sitting looking out the window. And there was a railroad yards across the valley, and I like to see the trains, the switches move, the switch engine move cars back and forth and so on. And yes, I didn't pay much attention. And father was as he'd been, he doesn't have enough to do. And the fifth and sixth grade were in the same room, same teacher. So father said, well, just put him in the sixth grade and that'll keep him busy. So I moved to the sixth grade, and then I guess I behaved myself and finished the sixth grade, and the next year I went to seventh grade, and again my teacher complained to father that, well, I didn't pay any attention. I was always wool gathering or doing something, and he said, well, she doesn't have enough to do. Do something to keep him busy. So she suggested, well, I could take arithmetic with the eighth grade. So I did this. I did all the seventh grade plus the arithmetic with the eighth grade, and apparently that kept me busy. But then, of course, this simply compounded the problem, because the next year, when I would have been in the eighth grade, I'd already had all the arithmetic.
Yes.
So somebody suggested, I don't know who, well, during the summer I could study at home and at high school, which I did. I don't remember that I studied a great deal, But yeah, my parents quizzed me on English, history, and civics, a few things. So I entered high school really 2 years early. See, I did from the fifth to the eighth in 2 years.
Yes. Well, now, got you at the end of your college time. How did you decide to go to graduate school, or did you decide to immediately go to graduate school?
Yes. Before I graduated, I decided I would go to graduate school, but by this time, I was really getting much interested in chemistry, and yes, I decided I'd go to graduate school. I spent 1 year at Colorado, took a master's degree there. This was largely determined by the fact that I was elected by the Alpha Sigma chapter to represent them at Pittsburgh at the biennial conference. And this implied that I would go back to my own chapter for at least a year, which I did. But I think the year at graduate school in Colorado was very good for me. And the reason I went to Michigan to continue my graduate work.
Let me just clarify one question. When you talk about Colorado, did you do your undergraduate work at?
At Boulder.
At Boulder, not at Colorado School of Mines.
No,
but at
no.
Boulder. And then you stayed on there for the master's degree.
No. Yes. No, the Colorado School of Mines at that time had only one curriculum, mining engineering.
I see.
And if you didn't want to be a mining engineer, that was no place for you.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the reason I went to Michigan seems now like a silly reason. When I was going to Pittsburgh to the Alpha Sigma Conference, I thought, well, I've never been in the East, and it might be ideal since I was going to be in the East of Pittsburgh to spend the summer in some Eastern school. And I got catalogs, and it turned out summer school at Michigan started the week after the meeting in Pittsburgh, so I could just go from Pittsburgh to Ann Arbor and spend the summer there, which I did. But during that summer, I took three courses, all in physics, so I was listed as a major in physics. But I enjoyed Ann Arbor, and I lived at the Alpha Sigma House during that summer, and I liked the boys there, so I thought, well, I'll go to graduate school and get my doctor's degree in Michigan. And as you see, my life wasn't very thoroughly planned. But anyway, that's why I went back to Michigan. And I had decided I wanted to be an organic chemist. And at Michigan at that time, there were only three professors who had graduate students, one in organic, one in physical, and one analytical. And so I just worked with Mr. Gomberg. That was it. I had no choice but to be an organic chemist. I worked with Gomberg. And this suited me all right because he was a very famous chemist, and I thought I would learn a great deal from him. So I spent 3 years at Ann Arbor. I was not, unfortunately, things didn't work out as well as I had hoped at Ann Arbor. I wasn't very happy there. In fact, I was quite unhappy most of the time. My research didn't go as well as I thought it should. And I didn't learn as much from Professor Garberg as I thought I would. He was a very fine teacher, but I don't think he was a very good person to teach graduate students. As we were just his hands, we did exactly what he told us. He came into the laboratory 5 or 6 times every day and asked each one, well, what have you done since I saw you last? Well, this seems to last 2 hours ago. All that we could do was say, well, I did what you told me to do. And I discovered that, because he was working on free radicals. Well, I wasn't much interested in free radicals. And that was also part of my unhappiness. So the day that I got my doctor's degree was a great day for me.
It didn't take you very long to get your graduate work done at Michigan, though.
I was there 3 years.
3 years, yeah.
Oh, no, it wasn't. I think that was more or less standard at that time.
Okay.
Yeah.
How large was Gomberg's group? How many people did he
have? Oh, he would never take more than 3 or 4 students at a time. That is, total. He'd take 1 or 2 a year. While I was there 2 of the years I was there, he had a postdoc and 3 graduate students. Mm-hmm. That's all he would take. So in his whole career, he only had about 30 graduate students. And he thought I should take a job in the industry. He was quite displeased with me when I had an offer from Eastman Kodak. And then I heard that there was an opening here.
At Illinois?
Yeah. I applied for that opening here. And before I heard anything at all, I turned down the job at Eastman. And the professor never thought that was a bad mistake. But fortunately, I got the job there. And it's an interesting bit of story. Professor Hopkins, who was here, wrote to Professor Willard, who was head of the analytical chemistry at Michigan, saying they had an opening here. And Professor Willard brought this letter around to my research lab. Well, I was out. He left the letter with one of the other boys. And when I came in and read it, I was as high as a kite. Oh, this is wonderful. This is just what I'd like to have. And so Professor Gottberg, and I told him about it, he said, oh, there's no use your applying there. So they don't need any organic chemists in Illinois. And he quite discouraged me. He said, no, there's no use in your applying. So I took the letter back to Professor Willard. And as I entered his office, letter in hand, he said, are you interested in this? And I said, well, yes, but Professor Gottberg, he says, I'll get that job for you. So it was a Saturday, and he sat down, no secretary there, he sat down at the typewriter and typed out a letter of recommendation, put an envelope, sealed it, said, you take this to the post office and mail it. And a day or so later, well, 3 or 4 days later, letter came saying that my letter had made a good impression, but they couldn't promise me anything until they heard from other applicants. But I just hung on hoping, and there it was.
And what year was that?
That was 1928.
Yeah. And that position here at Illinois was, what was the nature of that position?
Well, teaching freshman chemistry. You see, it was the custom at that time. We had a lot of freshmen taking chemistry, and there weren't many graduate students. Well, I was not allowed to have graduate students. You had to do some own research with your own hands before you could have any students to work with you. But the custom was they'd bring in 2 or 3 young people each year, and they would teach freshman chemistry for 2 or 3 years, and then some job would show up that looked promising, and they would urge this young man to go off, and so on. And had I kept doing organic chemistry, that would have been my fate, because there was no place here for me as an organic chemist.
They already had a full staff.
Well, they had Adams Marble, Fusana Schreiner, which was enough.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was in the great shakes as an organic chemist anyway.
So you came then basically as a member of the, would you say, of the general chemistry teaching faculty?
Right.
And was that synonymous with inorganic chemistry?
Yes, yes. The inorganic staff handled the freshman chemistry.
And so the person that you reported to was whom?
Professor Hopkins.
Hopkins.
Yeah.
And his title was?
He was professor of chemistry.
But he was, did they have a divisional structure then?
No, well, they had it, yes, but I don't think he, officially his title was not professor of inorganic chemistry, just professor of chemistry. But he was in charge of all the inorganic chemistry and the freshman chemistry. I say all the inorganic, there wasn't much inorganic. We had just 2 graduate courses. Well, one advanced undergraduate and 1 graduate course. That's all.
Well, who were the staff that you were with in that group as a teacher of general chemistry?
Well,
Guy Hopkins, yourself.
There was Eintema and Kramer's, and Audrey's came the same time I did, and Miss Bartow, and Miss Parr, and there was a young man named Gillers who then came a year or so before I did, who left soon thereafter, went to some other job.
Mm-hmm.
That was about it.
So then, were you given a place of a laboratory in which? Where was your office? Your first office?
Way around in the far corner of the third floor
of Noyes Laboratory.
Yeah, uh-huh. But I was there a year and a half. Then I moved around somewhere in this vicinity. I don't remember.
You were on the third floor of Noyes.
Yes. Then Professor Eichmann, who was an assistant there, he was scheduled to move over to the annex when that building was built. But just about that time, he was offered a position as head of the department at St. Louis University, and Kramer's took a job in industry, and Audrey and Quill, who joined the staff here after I did, both went to Europe on fellowship, so there was nobody to sit in the chemistry annex office but me. So I was sent over there to take charge of the freshman chemistry.
I see. Now, Hopkins' office was here at Noyes Laboratory.
That's right. He was across the office.
Of course, at this time now, the Noyes Lab was constructed, this part of Noyes Lab was constructed in 1916,
that's
and
right.
this is 1928, 1929.
Yeah, that's right.
So this was a comparatively new building.
Yes, this was considered one of the buildings of chemistry in the whole country.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you went to the annex, which was a new building then?
We moved in there in the middle of the 30-31 school year.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved in there in February 1931.
And in that, and did you become then the director of general chemistry?
Well, Professor Hopkins was really the director, but after a little while, I sort of just grew into that job, and he eased out a little.
How did you feel in those early years about the relationship between your function as a teacher and your career, your role as a researcher? When you came here, was it your idea that you were coming primarily to teach or primarily to do research?
I came primarily to teach,
yeah.
In fact, I remember during my last year at Michigan talking to one of the other graduate students, saying that what I hoped to get was a job in a good small college where I could teach. And then, as the year wore on, I began to think, I'd rather be in a big school, but in a small town. I didn't want to live in a big city. So this job was just perfect for what I was looking for.
Well, how was the job portrayed to you? I mean, what was there a sense when you came that you were going to be expected to do more than just teach, that you were expected to do research?
Yes. The first day I was here, I was told to go and talk to Professor Adams. And he spent about an hour with me, and among the things we talked about, he asked me, what sort of research do you plan to do? And I outlined a program which I had in mind. He said, well, that sounds all right, and so forth. And then he sent me up to Professor Hopkins, and he also asked me, what are you going to do here in research? And so again, I told him about this. And he, I'm not sure it was that day, but sometime later, he pointed out to me that, well, I have an organic degree in organic chemistry, and it would be nice if I would work on rare alkenes. We could distill these and get a separation of the rare. Fortunately, I didn't accept that invitation because other people have tried this. And
it took a long time to make the first rare earth alkene.
That's right, yes. And they're not volatile either.
Yeah. Well, that is an interesting question. Now, how did you decide upon a research program? When did you first get interested in coordination compounds?
Well, even as a graduate student at Michigan, as I said, I wasn't much interested in free radicals. I was interested in isomerism and molecular rearrangements and so on. And so when I came here, my idea was to work on molecular rearrangements and isomers. Well, I was teaching freshman class. One day we had on the board the reaction, the equation for the reaction of antimony chloride and water. It gives SBOCl. And one of the students in the class asked me, he wanted to ask a question about that antimony hypochlorite. And I said, well, that's not a hypochlorite. He says, OCl, hypochlorite. I said, oh, but this is not a hypercarite. He said, why isn't it a hypercarite? It's OCL. So I explained to him the difference between an oxychloride and a hypochlorite. And while I was discussing this with this student, it suddenly occurred to me, if we had a metal with a valence of 1, and the same metal with a valence of 3, we could form isomers. See, we could have a hypochlorite of the monovalent metal and the oxychloride of the trivalent metal. And so as soon as the class was over, I went to the library and began to look around, and I found, well, thallium. Valence of 1, valence of 3. So I set out to make these two thallium compounds. But you can't make thallus hypochlorite, because the thallus ion is easily oxidized, and hypochlorite is a strong oxidizer. But this was the first idea I had. I made a hobby of trying to think of cases of inorganic isomers. When I was mowing the lawn or waiting for the bus or something, or lying asleep in bed waiting to fall asleep. I'd think about possible inorganic isomers, most of which couldn't ever be formed. But I found it a very stimulating hobby. And anyway, you can't go very far in inorganic chemistry in the subject of isomerism without getting into coordination compounds. And so I began to read the papers by Werner and Pfeiffer and other prominent inorganic chemists. And the first piece of research we ever did on this subject was on a Walden inversion experiment, which happily turned out well. Take an inorganic compound, an optically active compound, and convert it into another compound of the opposite configuration.
And that was a cobalt complex.
Yes, it was a cobalt complex. And I had an undergraduate student working with me who did that work. Come in.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't know where we were after that.
Well, then we.
You asked how what came after that.
Began to talk a little bit about where your research went from that point.
I got interested in coordination compounds in general through that isomerism subject, and we synthesized some new compounds, which was not always easy, and did some other experiments in coordination compounds, but mostly it was isomerism, stereo isomerism particularly. We did do some work on inorganic polymers at one time, but that didn't amount to very much, and I was glad to get back to stereochemistry again.
I think I asked you when you first came here, you were a young instructor. The rank of instructor was in vogue at that time.
That's right, yeah.
And you remained an instructor for how long?
Well, I was an instructor for 2 years, and then I was an associate for 5 years. That was during the Depression time, and there were no promotions of any sort in the university, and no raises in pay. In fact, we took a cut in pay, but prices went down too, so a cut in pay didn't hurt me very much. So, it was 7 years after I came here before I became an assistant professor. But the man who came the year after I did was caught in the Depression. There wasn't enough money to keep everybody on, so he was let go.
When you were a young faculty member here, you first came, whom did you turn to for advice? Who was your mentor among the other faculty members in the department or in the university?
The person I went to for advice was Steve Marvin. He was 10 years older than I. He was an assistant professor at that time. But when I had a problem, I'd go and talk with him. And his judgment was sound, and he gave me good advice. And I've always felt that my progress here was due more to him really than to Professor Hopkins, who was a fighter and a pusher, and Professor Hopkins was.
What was your relationship to Hopkins?
Well, it was a very friendly relationship. I realized for many years that I was working under his direction, his guidance, and he was the boss of the inorganic group, so that I tried not to overstep my authority, confer with him, and there were decisions to be made about the freshman program and so on. And then when he came to the fourth edition of his textbook, he asked me if I would work with him in that, and we got along beautifully together. I'd go to his office two or three times a week, and we'd talk things over, and we'd do some writing and get together again. And he was rather a sensitive man. I soon learned that I should not criticize something that he had written. I could write something And I'd take it to him, and he'd say, that's fine. But if I'd say to him, well, now, what you've written is not very good, he didn't like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I quickly learned this. But early on that project, he said, well, now, I'm retired, and I have plenty of time to work on this, and you don't have as much time. Let's wait till the book is finished before we decide how we'll divide the royalties. And so we did this. We worked for well over a year together, not knowing, at least I didn't have any idea how much royalty I was going to get out of this book at all, but I trusted him, and apparently he trusted me. And so finally, when the book was finished, and we wrapped it up and sent it off, he said, now let's decide. He said, you write on a piece of paper what proportion you think you ought to have, and I will write on the paper what proportion I think you ought to have, and then we'll trade papers. I wrote 20%, he wrote 30%.
And, this was a revision of an already existing book, right? This was the fourth edition. And
yes.
He had been the sole author on the previous edition?
Right, yeah. So we agreed on 25% for me. I cite this simply to show how we trusted each other.
Yes, that shows a good relationship.
Yes, it was a very good relationship, and I enjoyed it very much.
That book went through several editions following that one, did it?
One more. Yes, and this was after he had died.
Mm-hmm.
I did the fifth edition by myself.
Now, you worked on that fourth edition after he had retired, did you say?
Yes.
So who became the more or less de facto leader of the inorganic and general chemistry group when Hopkins stepped down? Did you become that person?
Yes.
And this was what year, would you say?
1941.
Yes. The faculty at that time were Audred, who'd been here for the same length of time you had. Moeller had just arrived.
Moeller came a little before that, yes. And of course, Miss Bartow and Miss Parr were still here. And Copley was gone. I don't remember who was in here, aside from those people. Bill had gone.
Now, how did the other parts of inorganic chemistry develop during that time? Audrey was a non-metal chemist, largely.
Yeah, he was started nitrogen, later he got into phosphorus chemistry. And, of course, Moeller was interested in the rare earths. He sort of took over from Professor Hopkins on that.
When did you take your first graduate student?
1932, I guess, or 31.
You've been here about 3 years or so before you took your first
student. The first two students I had were signed up with Professor Adams.
Mm-hmm.
See, I was not on the graduate faculty, and so they had to sign with Professor Adams, but he turned them over to me, and the first one was an organic chemist. It was a molecular rearrangement problem, and the second one was an inorganic chemist.
And from that point then?
And after that, I was admitted to the graduate faculty and had my own students.
How was research funded in those days? Were there external sources of support, or were they all from the department?
There were no... there were some fellowships. The university had some fellowships, and we had a little money from DuPont, and there was a fellowship called the Carr Fellowship. But most of the graduate students were teachers, half-time teaching assistants. If you wanted chemical, you went to the storeroom and got it. And you didn't have to sign up for it or anything like this. There was no outside money to speak of. And if you needed a piece of equipment, well, if the department could afford it, they'd buy it. But if they couldn't afford it, you did without.
And who handled those decisions? Was that all through Professor Adams?
Yes. Business office in those days consisted of one man named Carl Miller, and Yeah, if you wanted a piece of equipment, you'd have to go to Adams, and if he felt that you were justified, he'd ask, what are you going to do with it, what experience do you have with it, and so on, I know, so forth, and if he thought that you knew what to do with it, or could afford it, he'd get it.
You needed a polarimeter, for example.
There was a polarimeter here. Yeah, okay. If there had not been a polarimeter, I suppose I would have had to plead for one and have to get it, yeah.
But the one that was here was adequate for your needs?
Oh, yes. It was a very good polarimeter. It was a little hard to use. It was a great big thing, and there was an arc lamp later replaced by a big incandescent bulb. But if you wanted a given wavelength, it was you turned the knob and moved a prism.
Yes.
And then you had to readjust the whole thing to get from 0 point to zero, so forth. But you could read it to 1,000th of a degree once you got it set up.
What sort of group sizes did people have in those days? How many students did you have during the 1930s, for example? What would have been the largest group that you had at any point in terms of number of students?
Oh. Probably 6 or 8, or maybe 10. That'd be a big group.
That would be. And
of course, in organic. Organic was, they had larger groups. Adams would have maybe 20 students. Marvel would have maybe 20, something like this. But an inorganic, I remember one year, the big year, 1940, when Audrey had 4 students to take doctor's degrees, and I had 4 take degrees. I was 8 PhDs in inorganic. We thought, we had really accomplished something.
There weren't very many centers of inorganic chemistry in those days. Illinois seemed to have become a center through Hopkins, presumably sort of leading the way, but certainly yourself and Audrey, your careers developing.
When I came here, I think there were only 3 or 4 schools in the United States where you could get a doctor's degree in inorganic. Cornell, Chicago, California, Illinois, maybe 1 or 2 others, but that was about it. And, Michigan, when I was a student there, Professor Lichty taught a course in inorganic for graduate students, but he never had more than 2 or 3 students. He didn't do any research, so on. So that, it was a very different situation here than I was used to. And Professor Hopkins was very generous. Some students who'd come here planning to work with him, and after a semester or so, they said, no, they'd work with Audrey if they're with me. Professor Hopkins never complained about this or anything. His groups he never did have a big group. The rarest didn't seem to attract many students, but in his last years, he had no students at all. And Audrey and I, and Mulder began to have some.
You publish your work in those days?
The Journal of the American Chemical Society. That was the only place you could publish.
But that, what were the, where did you, what literature did you read? There were, on the international scene, there were journals that specialized in inorganic.
Yes. Well, mostly I read the German literature, Werner's work, and people who followed him. And the British Chemical, the Journal of Chemical Society, the Journal of American Chemical Society. Occasionally, you'd find an article in an Australian journal or something like this, but the big source of information was either German literature or the JACS.
It was also a very different situation in those days as far as the numbers of people who thought of themselves as inorganic chemists. There was no division of inorganic chemistry and so on. How did you communicate with colleagues? What were the major mechanisms of communicating with them?
You mean in other schools?
In other schools,
you give papers at the National ACS meeting. Of course, there was no division of inorganic. It was lumped in with physical. So you present a paper in the Division of Physical and Inorganic Chemistry. And there were never very many people there to hear your talk. And really, you didn't communicate much with other people.
It was a more flourishing school in Europe. Did you write?
Yes.
Write a lot? Was there
no. Fairly... No, I didn't ever do that at all. I read the British and the German journals, but I didn't have any personal contact with those people at all. And we were just on our own here.
That's just before we go on to some talking about the way in which inorganic chemistry and international chemistry developed. Let's talk a little bit about the university here. You talked about the Department of Chemistry. Was it considered in those days to be one of the strong departments of the university?
Oh, yes.
I take it that it was.
Yes.
Adams had a great influence here.
Well, of course, Noyes came in 1970. He was a very strong leader. And he retired in 26, and Adams took over, and he also was a strong leader. So between the two of them, they had built this up into a very powerful department.
Yes.
Noyes brought in people like Rodebush and Marvel, Clark. Noyes was very particular in choosing his people, and he chose strong people.
Yeah. How about the relationship with other departments on campus? Was it a, you characterize the environment in those days as more collegial than it is today?
Well, it's hard to tell. I suppose it was. Of course, the university only had 10,000 or 12,000 students when I came, so that it was easier to meet people. And then, of course, I was on the active staff, and I soon began to get committee appointments and things of this sort, so that I met people from many other departments. Now, for 15 years, I haven't been on a committee at all outside the department, so that I don't meet people anymore.
Yeah.
It's really hard to compare those days with these. But yes, I think it was easier, though, back in those days to be with other people.
One of the interesting issues that comes up a lot these days is the relationship of academic departments to industry. And how would you say, what sorts of interactions with industry did you as a faculty member have back in the 30s and the 40s, and how would that, or how did this department relate to industry in those days compared with how it does today?
Oh, there was very much less contact.
Less, you think?
Oh, yes, in those early days, yes. Adams and Marvel, I guess, were both consultants at DuPont. And I guess Adams also was a consultant at the laboratory. But I wasn't conscious of any interaction with industry at all until I was appointed to take charge of the placement. Then, of course, industry people came, and I met them all, and I learned what they were doing. And this was part of the job, of course, of placing students. Now, before that, Marvel had handled placement work, but he did it on a very informal basis. He couldn't do anything on a formal basis, I guess. He didn't build that way. But I was given an extra girl in the office to handle appointments and things of this sort. And that placement work, that was a very interesting job. I get acquainted with these industrial people, and then I'd find I'd hear something, and I think, this student would be interested in that. This man would like that student. So I'd go to the laboratory and find the student and take him and say, look, I want you to see this man because you like him or he'll like you. And frequently the answer would be, I don't even have a necktie. So I had some extra neckties in my office. I'd say, well, you can wear my necktie. And one man was in the hospital. He had an appendicitis operation. So I took the personnel man in my car and drove to the hospital.
You took your job very seriously.
I did indeed. I thought it was a great job. I loved it. But it got to be such a big job, I finally decided, well, either I can be a placement man or I can be a chemist. I can't be both.
Yes.
So I had to quit.
You were doing that along with running the general chemistry program and along with running your research.
Yes.
What years were that? What were those placement years when you were doing that?
41 to... No, so before that. Started back in the early 30s, or middle 30s, up until about 1951.
Mm-hmm.
I was also then, most of that time, I was had the title of Secretary of the Department, which really meant that I did whatever Roger Adams asked me to do. I had charge the administrative charge of the machine shop, the microanalytical laboratory, the summer school, and when we were building the Roger Adams lab, I took the architect on a tour of labs, tried to teach him what the chemistry lab should be like, and so on. Oh, I had a tremendous number of things to do, and I used to get over here, well, 4 or 8 in the morning, and stay till noon, and be back before 1, just in case some teacher couldn't show up or something. I had to find a substitute or teach the class myself, and then I'd come back in the evenings and work. And as a consequence, a lot of the research that my students did didn't get published.
Mm-hmm.
I had time to supervise them, but I didn't have time to write up papers. In fact, I'm writing one right now from a student who took her doctor's degree in 1951.
Fine.
Well, it's still good chemistry.
Good stuff that hasn't been done.
It hasn't been done. I'm going to try to write it up and get it, put it in a journal.
That reminds me to ask you about your family life. When did you marry?
I married Florence in 1931.
You met Florence here at Illinois?
Yeah, she had been a student here, an undergraduate. Well, she took a master's degree here in 28. And then she went to Rochester, New York, to work in a hospital. She was in biochemistry. And after a year, she came back. And I met her. I'd been here for 1 year then, and I met her here in the chemistry room. And we were married 2 years later.
And your sons were born in...
Yes, they were
what
born...
What years?
Yeah, we were married in 31. The first son was born in the fall of 32, and the next one in the spring of 34. Yeah, they're just 18 months apart. And, yes, Florence and I were very happy together. She had a double major as an undergraduate student in chemistry and math. So when the war came on and they needed teachers, she took a job in the math department. And she taught math for about 20 years. And by this time the boys were up, you know, close to high school age. They get along. So, and she always had scheduled in the morning so that the boys would go off to school and she'd come over here and do her teaching. And by the time they got home for lunch, she was home too. So it worked out very well.
You lived on Pennsylvania Avenue during
all
that time?
All that time.
Did you?
We bought a small house on Pennsylvania Avenue before we were married, actually. We couldn't actually buy it because a man and a woman who are not married can't buy a house jointly, according to the law. But we had everything down except the final signature. So when we came back from our honeymoon, we moved into this house that we had already arranged for. And that day, I guess, we signed up the papers and it was our house. Then a few years later, after the two boys were born, we decided we needed a larger house, so we bought a house almost across the street from where we were living. And we lived there, well, until she died in 1975. And I lived there by myself after that for time. And then when I married Catherine, well, that's an interesting bit. Of course, the boys were grown up and gone by that time, and her children were grown up. so that the two of us were living in this big 10-room house, and she didn't quite like this idea. And as a matter of fact, I think that it wasn't her kind of house. And so after a year or two, we decided we'd get a smaller house, which we did very quickly. And so we lived further out now. I wish we were closer to the campus, but you can't have everything.
Well, you wouldn't be walking or riding your bicycle much these days anymore anyway, but earlier on, I suspect you walked to work
and
rode your bike all the time.
Yes, yes,
easy
of
distance. So.
Yes. And I didn't ride the bus much until recent years. Mm-hmm. Of course, now the bus comes just a block from our house and lets me off a block from the chemistry building. So it's very easy. So mostly I use the bus.
Let me go back to one question before we leave the industry business. I remember reading in Tarbell's book about Roger Adams, the business about the sort of chemical synthesis operations that went on here, started, I guess, by Adams during World War I to provide specialty chemicals which were no longer importable. But that seemed to have gone on for many years afterwards, sort of summer work or part-time work.
That's right.
Were you ever involved in that?
Well, in a minor way. I persuaded Speed after I've been here some time, that we ought to have an inorganic chemist to make inorganic chemicals. So for two or three years we did this. Our biggest project, I guess, was making mercuric sulfate for Professor Rose up in biochemistry. He was using mercuric sulfate to precipitate amino acids and so on. And the big advantage in us doing it here was that we could, we didn't have to crystallize the stuff out or bottle it up, ship it. So we just take metallic mercury, and he always added, when he bought mercuric sulfate, he dissolved in water and added a certain amount of sulfuric acid. But we could add that amount of extra sulfuric acid to our original material, you see, and so all we had to do was heat it up until all the mercury had been oxidized, change the sulfate, haul it down the hall, and he could pour it out and use it.
Mm-hmm.
And we made some other inorganic compounds too.
Were those sold then to Eastman?
The organic compounds were sold to a variety of people outside. Yeah. That was the original purpose, of course, because as you pointed out, during the war they couldn't import these chemicals, and so they set up this inorganic organic manufacturers, and they'd have a group of 10, 12, 15 graduate students work all summer, 40 cents an hour, but they also got credit in organic preps. And the chemicals were sold. And gradually, of course, as the American chemical industry built up, that need declined. And eventually, I think there was a feeling that we were competing with American industry and we shouldn't do this, so the whole thing was just dropped.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very interesting project while it lasted. You'd go in the lab down there, 219, and see all these big flasks boiling away, you know. It was like the old alchemical age.
Semi-works almost.
Yeah, yes it was. 22-liter flask they had. A 22-liter flask is a big flask, you know.
Yes, indeed. Well, John, I think we're drawing close to the end of this first tape. I think maybe we'll pause here and take on some additional questions in the next session.
Okay, that's fine. Yeah.
Bring it to a close here.
tone here. And now this is Ted Brown interviewing John C. Baylor, Jr. This is our second interview. The first was held on May 28, 1987, and this one is being held on June 17, 1987.
Let's start, John, by talking a little bit about the history of your involvement with the American Chemical Society. When did you first join the American Chemical Society?
I joined when I was still a graduate student at Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I had no intention at that time of becoming highly active. The people at Michigan didn't have much interest in the American Chemical Society, at least as a national organization. Professor Willard was fairly regular in attending the national meetings, but nobody else on the staff there did. And it just didn't occur to me that this was the thing to do. And so after I came down here, well, it was the spring, the first spring that I was here in Urbana, Professor Hopkins came to my office one day and asked, "Are you going to the meeting?" And I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, "Well, what meeting do you mean? I suppose it was some local meeting here on the campus or something." "Well," he says, the National Meeting of the American Chemical Society." And I sort of stuttered and stammered about this. "Well, I don't know, I hadn't thought anything about it." "Well," he says, "we expect our people to go." And so, of course, I went.
Just wanted to check it.
Yeah. Well, I rather enjoyed the meeting and met some people that I had known before, and also met some new friends. And
well, where was that meeting?
Oh, I don't remember. I think it was in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, this was almost 60 years ago.
Yeah.
But I think it was Minneapolis. But because I did find it worthwhile, I just went fairly regularly thereafter. In fact, I think I've missed only two national meetings in the last 60 years.
What was the character of those meetings in general? I mean, I seem to remember that there was actually a national meeting held here at Urbana at one point.
That was long before I came here,
mm-hmm.
in 1916, when this part of Noyes Laboratory was built.
Mm-hmm.
And the meeting was held here to commemorate the building, the completion of that new building. But this was national meetings in those days were very small, and well, the organic section held its meetings in room 103 in this building. And I remember Virginia Bartow told me there wasn't enough hotel space for the people who came here. I guess there weren't any hotels in Urbana to speak of, and so people who lived here in town took the delegates into their homes and entertained them during the week of the meeting. But that was before I came. But even after I began going to the meetings, in the early 30s, I attended a meeting at Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And we stayed in student dormitories. It was during spring vacation. The students had gone home for a week, and so we used their rooms. And Mike Coakley and I roomed together at that meeting. But, of course, the meetings are... The nature of the meetings was not very different. That is, there were sections, organic and inorganic and so forth, and so on. People gave talks. But the size of the meeting, of course, has grown enormously. And so now you couldn't possibly meet in a place like Chapel Hill, North Carolina, or Urbana. And
well, you were associated with, there was a strong divisional character to the meetings and to the ACS at that time. So you were associated with the physical.
Well, the physical and inorganic, yes. That was when the divisions were first set up in the society along in the early 1900s, physical and inorganic were lumped together. Division. The physical chemists, by the time I got here at least, the
physical division, the physical chemists, far outnumbered the inorganic chemists, so that practically the entire meeting was involved in physical chemistry things. There was hardly any inorganic at all. And but once in a while, the physical chemist would allow a meeting which had some inorganic in it. But the inorganic chemists were not very happy with this arrangement. And wanted their own division. I was elected secretary of the Division of Physical and Inorganic Chemistry, and this seemed to me a very strange arrangement, because I had, of course, been trained as an organic chemist, and I was still thinking more in terms of organic preparative descriptive chemistry than anything that the physical chemist would be interested in. But nonetheless, in the plan of now and then putting an inorganic chemist into an office, I was elected secretary.
What year would that have been?
That must have been about 19... I don't really remember. In the early 40s, I was there. And so I arranged the program and so forth, as the secretary was supposed to do. Well, the plan, or at least the custom, was for the secretary to advance to the position of chairman-elect, and then he would, of course, become chairman the next year. So over a period of 3 years, I went through this series of offices. And it became more and more evident to me that this was not a situation in which an inorganic chemist would be very happy. And I talked with Thurl Moore about it, and suggested to him that perhaps we should contact some other inorganic chemists and see if there was any feeling that there should be a division of inorganic chemistry. And as an upshot of our conversation, he and I made up a list of all the inorganic chemists we knew in the United States. We had about 100 names. Well, in order to start a new division, you had to have 50 people who would agree to join. So we sent a letter to these 100 people that we knew about, and I went to the Gordon Conference that year, and I took a copy of our letter with me, laid it on the table in the hall there in New Hampshire where the meeting was, with the suggestion anybody interested could sign up. Well, as a result of this and various other things, we got about 150 names of people who said they would join a division if there were such a division. So we met at a national ACS meeting and decided we would form a division. And I was appointed. See, any new division is always probationary, and it doesn't elect its own officers. The president of the society appoints officers. So I was appointed president, and Jake Warner was president of the society, and he appointed a steering committee. Actually, I gave him the list of names. He took the names without any question, and he appointed a secretary and chairman-elect and so on. And so we were off to a good start. And the next year, we became a full-fledged division. And that was about 28 or 29 years ago. I think 1957 was when we first met. But I'd have to check that to be sure.
That you, when you first talked to Thurl, I mean, it sounds as though several years transpired in there from the time you first talked to Thurl
yes.
about it and the time you actually became a
yes, kid. Yes, this is right. It was a while. I didn't want to upset the apple cart of the physical and inorganic division, but the longer I thought about it, the more I decided that inorganic chemistry was not going to thrive when it was really a subdivision of physical chemistry. It had to be on its own. And, of course, now it's one of the big divisions of the society. And
right.
One of the most active. And, of course, inorganic chemistry is not just what it was then. It is, it's expanded to become bio-inorganic chemistry and metal clusters and
organometallic chemistry is a large fraction of
yes, of course. So that has helped a great deal. Now you asked about the journal. Well, perhaps first I should say you asked about becoming president of the society. I was elected a counselor from the local section. Then later I was counselor for the inorganic and physical division, then I was counselor for the inorganic division, and I guess at one time I was counselor also for the division of chemical education. And I went to the council meetings quite regularly, and didn't usually say anything in the meetings, but at least I was there and voted, and so on. One day, Byron Regal, who was a member of the Committee on Nomination and Elections, came to me and said that they wanted to nominate me for presidency of the society. Well, I was just amazed. It had never occurred to me that I would be president.
What year was that, John? Do you recall?
That was about 51, something like that. And but I agreed to be a candidate. However, I was not elected. A couple of years later, they nominated me again. Again, I was not elected. But in 1957, they nominated me a third time, and this time I was elected and became president in the beginning of 1959. And that was a very interesting experience, though people told me that by the end of October of that year, I'd be tired of it. And this turns out to be pretty much the case. It takes quite a lot of time, and of course you meet interesting people and you do interesting things, but when you have to pile it on top of a regular job, it does get a little heavy. Soon after I was, the year I was president-elect, I had a letter from the New York section saying, well, it was a long-standing custom for the president give the address to the New York section in the January meeting. Well, I didn't want to upset any long-standing customs, so I went to New York and gave a talk. And, well, I also, about the same time, got a letter from the Philadelphia section saying it was a long-standing custom for the president to speak to the Philadelphia section at the February meeting. So, of course, I went to the February meeting in Philadelphia. And so this sort of thing. I don't think I was a very strong president. In fact, I was, frankly, I was told that the chairman of the board would be the fellow who really ran the meeting, and my job was more or less an honorary position. But even so, it took quite a little time, but I was glad to have it, and met some very interesting people. The job was a very interesting one, and so on. Well, while I was a member of the board, automatically because I was president of the society, I began pushing for the journal, Inorganic Chemistry. And I felt that there were enough inorganic chemists and enough research going on that we could well support a journal in that subject. And Al Noyes was president of the society, and I think he rather sided with me. Finally, he said one day, well, he says, I guess you're going to get your journal. And it is. It was an interesting bit about that. Soon after the board of directors voted to start this journal, Captain Maxwell, who was an Englishman, well, he's not really an Englishman, but he lived in England, came down from Chicago to see me. He said he was just starting a Journal of Inorganic Chemistry, the Journal of Inorganic and Nuclear Chemistry, and he asked me if I would delay our journal, why, 1 year till he could get his journal started. He says, if we start at the same time, you'll simply kill my journal. So I told him, all right, I would try to do that, though, of course, the board had the final say-so. But they did delay the beginning of this journal by 1 year, and he got his journal off the ground and going. And
it never was a terribly competitive journal, though,
no,
in most areas with...
No. The standards weren't very high, I'm afraid. I talked with him later about this, told him that I didn't think that his journal was as good as it should be, because they accepted practically anything that came in. And he said, well, he'd have to talk to the editor about it. Whether he ever did, I don't know. But the journal didn't improve much, I must say. But that's the way it grew up.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the start of that journal. It seemed to me you had a pretty strong hand. It wasn't one of your former students the first editor?
Yes, Bob Perry.
Did you have a hand in getting him involved in it?
Well, yes. The board of directors, of course, made the selection, and they considered several people, and I... when they mentioned Bob's name, I pushed for him, of course, because I felt that he would do a good job. He's a very meticulous person, has high standards. But it wasn't, I didn't first suggest his name, no. And so he got the journal off to a very good start. And I've always been proud of the fact that I had a little bit to do with starting the journal and selecting the editor.
Well, when your year of presidency with the ACS came to an end, was that sort of the end of your deep involvement with ACS, or have you had other involvements over the years?
Well, of course, once you've been president, you're a member of the council for life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still go to the council meetings quite regularly, and I was... a member of the Committee on Divisional Activities for 4 or 5 years, just fairly recently. But I found that there's so many things that I want to do when I go to those meetings that I finally asked not to be reappointed to the Committee on Divisional Activities. Though I found it interesting. Yeah, I like to keep my hand in. And,
have you noticed a significant change in the character of the society over the last 20 years or so? I mean, for example, in the role of the presidency, it seems to me that the president is a much more active person today.
Yes, this is certainly true. During, especially in the last few years, the president, the current president, Mrs. Mary Good, takes a very active role in organizing symposia and presiding at symposium meetings. And you see her picture in the papers very frequently and so on. This is quite a change. I was told quite almost bluntly when I assumed the presidency that this was an honorary position, and the president, the chairman of the board, would be the person who actually ran the society.
I suppose to some extent it's come about because chemistry has become much more involved, you know, politically and in the social consciousness. There's this concern about the image that chemistry has, and we have to be...
Yes.
We're looking more to the outside than we used to.
Yes, much more. That's right. We didn't worry much about the image of chemistry back in the early days, I think. That's early days, my early days. Though I have been conscious of the fact since I was a boy that chemistry has a bad image in some ways. When I was still in high school, during the First World War, the U.S. Government had a laboratory at the Cutler School of Mines, where my father was a professor, doing war research. They had some chemists there, And I heard people speak about how these chemists were warmongers and so on. And so that for many years I've had this consciousness that many people think of chemists as being people who create explosives and poisons and for the destruction of other people and so on. And I've tried to point out that while chemists do these things, they also have done tremendously good things, increasing our comfort, our length of life, and so on and so on, so that on balance the chemistry profession has accomplished a great deal of good.
How did you get involved in IUPAC?
I don't really quite know. I was selected by the powers that be to attend a couple of their congresses, and at one of these congresses they decided they needed to revamp their constitution, and so copies were given, copies of the constitution as it was then, were given to a lot of people at the Congress, and we were asked to go over it and make suggestions. And so I spent quite a little time on it. I thought it was sort of fun. And I revamped the arrangement of it. And I sent this in to the Secretary General, Dr. Rudolph Moore, and apparently he was reasonably well impressed with it, because and I was invited to go to Europe to visit with him, and he introduced me to the man who was then the treasurer, well, not the treasury, the he represented the bank. He was more like a super bookkeeper or something. And the next thing I knew, I was like the treasurer.
And, elected by the IUPAC board? Or something.
Yeah. I think Al Noyes had a good deal to do with this, though he never told me that. But he did tell me about how they had deliberated on who would be treasurer, and he named a couple other people that they considered and said that they would never be treasurer, and so on. So I think Al Noyes had a good deal to do with it. But,
this is William Albert Noyes, Jr.,
yes.
Who was editor of Jacks for so long.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. Well, of course, his father was editor of Jacks, too, so that doesn't distinguish it. But now this is Jr., who was then at the University of Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he had been president of the American Chemical Society, and I knew him through that connection. So that, that's the only, this sort of burst upon me. I had no realization that I would be chosen to be treasurer. But I was treasurer for 8 years, and because I was treasurer, I was also a member of the executive committee and went to meetings usually about twice a year. We had meetings of the executive committee, so I traveled a great deal. And I found this to be a very stimulating organization. It covers such a wide range of things. And it took a great deal of time. I had to approve all the bills, help make out the budgets and this sort of thing. The Secretary General, Dr. Morris, had apparently been the actual treasurer, though he was not elected treasurer. He was the Secretary General. But the man who was treasurer before me, I went to see him as soon as I was elected and asked him, well, what What do I do? Can you give me some instructions? Well, he says, let's meet for lunch. So we met for lunch, and we had a very pleasant lunch, but nothing was said about how I should be treasurer. And finally I asked him, well, what do I do? And he said, well, here's a checkbook. There it is. That's it. Well, I discovered that he had let Dr. Morse do all the work for the treasurer. But I didn't want to do that. I thought if I was treasurer, I was going to be treasurer. And Dr. Morse, I think, didn't like this very well, because he was a man who loved to have power.
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, we got along pretty well.
As I remember, I think that I may misremember this, but I was fairly new on the faculty at the time. When you went to one of those first meetings, you and Florence went. It was your first trip to Europe. Was that? Do I remember that? Because it would have been about 57.
Yes, that's 57. That's yeah. Right. That was our first trip.
I remember all the excitement of your going off.
Oh yes, yes. This was the first sabbatical leave I had had. And the first time I'd ever been out of the United States.
It was a sabbatical?
You actually? Yeah. I took the fall semester, and we visited in, I guess, almost all of the countries in Western Europe. And I visited chemical laboratories and talked to chemists, inorganic chemists especially. And we went to Rome to the meeting of the UPAC, and well, I gave a paper there, as a matter of fact, and I found this very stimulating. That, I met so many interesting people from Europe and Australia and South Africa and all sorts of places, and it really opened my eyes to what a broad field chemistry is. And I've attended all of the UPAC meetings since then. No, I haven't either. I did for several years, and then I quit going to those because I got involved in some other things too. But yes, I think UPAC is a very important organization, and if we had more international organizations in other fields, I think we'd learn a lot more about how foreign people think and act.
While we're talking about that kind of thing, another memory I have of those early years when I came to Illinois in 56 was that we had quite a string of German seminar speakers, mainly at the behest of Lou Audrey.
Do
you want to say a little bit about what was Lou's sort of relationship to German chemistry at the time? He seemed to be very closely tied to that.
Yeah, well, of course, Lou was born in Austria. His native language was German. He came to this country when he was a young man. Well, he was just a baby, I guess, but his folks always spoke German at home, I think. And he did visit Germany several times. And as a matter of fact, in 1930, he went back to Germany and spent a year on some sort of a fellowship. And he met a good many German chemists and became interested in their work and so forth. And he also spent some time in Italy and became interested in the Italian inorganic chemists. So that, yes, after he came back,
Excuse me, he translated a German text. Was it Walden's book or somebody's book?
Well, that was before he came here.
Uh-huh.
See, when he was at Cornell as a postdoc, Red Walden.
May have been a book on non-aqueous solvents or something like that.
No, it was the George Fisher Baker lecture series. George Fisher Baker left a lot of money to Cornell to bring. And so they had this German chemist, whose name I can't think of just at the moment, and Lou became well acquainted with him and translated the book into English. I have a copy of it or something. But he was always interested in European chemistry and in especially German chemistry. And, in fact, he got himself into some troubles along in the early 30s when he spent a year in Germany. And Hitler was just coming into power then. And Lou was under the impression that Hitler was doing some good things for Germany. He changed his mind later. But he made some talks around here about Hitler's work in Germany. And even then, some of the Americans were very suspicious of Hitler. And Lou was, well, I don't know what you say. He was questioned about it. He was criticized for it. And of course, it turns out that his favorable impression of Hitler was a little bit wrong.
Yeah.
But, Lou came and joined the staff here at the same time I did, fall of 28.
Right.
And he had been to Europe just that summer, as a matter of fact. He traveled a great deal. And he was late getting here because on the ship coming back, somebody got scarlet fever. And so when the ship came into New York Harbor, it was quarantined. They wouldn't let anybody off until the quarantine period is over. So he was maybe a week late getting here in the fall. But
I think
he came at a higher rank than I did. He'd had 2 years of postdoctoral work. And so he was an associate and I was an instructor.
Yeah, and he had already done that National Research Council fellowship.
Yes, that's right.
So basically he was about 3 years ahead of you, maybe.
Two years. And then soon after that, when they built the chemistry annex, Professor Eitema was supposed to take over the work in the chemistry annex. And just at that time, he got an offer from St. Louis University to be head of the department. So he went to St. Louis. And Kramers, who was here, took a job with Roman Haas. Lou took a fellowship to go back to Germany for a year. And Quill, who was older than I and more experienced, also got a job at a fellowship in Germany. So that when the chemistry annex was ready, I was told, well, you go over and...
You were the only one.
Yeah, I was the only one left. And I stayed in.
So you stayed in the chemistry annex for 35 years.
Then. Yeah, about that.
But you had your research labs over in Noy's lab.
Yes, on third floor. A little inconvenient to be on, have your office on the first floor of one building and your research students on the third floor of another.
Well, you got a lot of exercise that probably contributed to your longevity.
Well, maybe. I probably didn't see my students as often as I should have. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that's bad. When I was a graduate student, Professor Gomberg came into the laboratory 4, 5, 6 times every day to check on what I was doing. I don't think I learned independence as I should have. I just did what he told me to do.
Yeah.
But when I didn't see my students that often, they had to think on their own, well, what do I do next?
Let's talk a little bit about your students. You've had some very eminent students, that is, students who've gone on to be quite eminent chemists. What, people like Fred Vasolo and Daryl Bush and Bob Perry and many others. How many students have there been altogether? Do you know the number of
PhDs? Yes, I've had 90 PhD students.
90?
90 who'd finished the PhD degree, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I had only 2 or 3 who started and who didn't finish.
Uh-huh.
And then I had a few who took master's degrees and left. And I don't know how many undergraduate students have done research with me, but I suppose it'd be 40, something of that sort.
And have you had postdocs over the years? I don't remember that you've had very many postdocs, but you've had some, I guess.
Yes, I've had 25 or 30.
That many?
Yes. A good many, 12 or so from Japan.
Oh, yes, of course. I remember.
I found the Japanese very well trained and good hard worker.
Yes.
So, yes, I've had several of them. And
What sort of a philosophy do you feel you have a certain kind of philosophy in approaching graduate education, research, and teaching?
Well, I've always felt that a research student should be given as much independence as he can take. And I assign them, usually a student doesn't know what to start on, so I assign them a problem. But after a while, the student sees a side road that he thinks is interesting, I encourage him to go ahead and try it. This is how Daryl Bush got involved in these polycycles that he's worked on so long. He started that while he was a graduate student here. And, he was taking a course with me. And something I said in the lecture stimulated him, so he came up to me and said, well, what if we did so-and-so? Why don't you try it? And he did try it, and this developed into this whole area that he's explored for many years. Bob Severs was a very interesting student to have because he clearly wanted to do it on his own. And I'd stop at his desk and talk to him, ask him, well, how are things going? Oh, fine, fine, fine. But he never would say, well, look, I'm having trouble with this or this or this. And when he wrote his thesis, he thanked me for letting him do it his own way. And, I think this expresses my philosophy pretty well. I give the students every opportunity to do what they feel is interesting and what they feel they can do. And maybe this is because I haven't really felt very competent to direct them. Do it themselves. And I remember Carl Rawlinson, when he took his degree, he commented to me, here, I'm just getting to the place where I can do research, and then you tell me I got to go. And I said, well, after all, you came to learn how to do research, and you've learned it, haven't you? He said, well, yeah, I guess so. So, that is it. That was quite different from anything that I had been. See, all of Professor Gomberg's students worked on free radicals. And if a student thought he wanted to work on molecular rearrangements, no, he worked on free radicals. And frankly, I wasn't much interested in free radicals.
Yeah.
So my graduate work wasn't as happy as it could have been.
Well, we mentioned a couple of your students. Who are some others that come to your mind as some of the more memorable ones? Fred Vasolo, I guess, is...
He has become perhaps the most prominent one. Hans Jonassen is another one who's done very well. It's extremely interesting man to have around. Incidentally, he was here only 2 years. He took a master's degree at Tulane, and he came up here. His wife didn't want to... She had a job down there. She didn't want to come. So he was eager to get this work finished as quickly as he could. And he worked day and night, summer and winter, vacations and everything. And in 2 years, he was gone. And he went back to Tulane and taught there until he retired. Well, let's see, who else? I should mention some others.
When I came here, I kind of inherited that office over in the annex, which was next to your office, and that was a place that Bob Perry had worked when he was here.
Yes, yes, that's right. Of course, the first student I had was only an undergraduate student, Bob Auk, but he did an outstanding piece of research, and this set me off on a track that I followed for a long time. But, well, Reynolds was a very good student, but he taught at Ohio State afterwards, but he died when he was still a young man. And Eugene Huffman was one of my early students who did very well. He went to the University of California eventually and worked there until he retired. Several have gone into industrial work. Dick Dalton is the vice president of one of the DuPont divisions now. And of course, the first graduate student I had was an organic chemist. This was Theophilus Parsons. And Speed Marble didn't like that very well, for me to have an organic student, because the department was highly divisionalized. And he told me quite out and out that he didn't like this. And people doing organic chemistry, he wanted them under his direction. And but about that time I was becoming more interested in inorganic chemistry anyway. So all the rest of my students were inorganic majors. As Jim Qualiano was another one who worked in, was a very good student.
Another student at DuPont, Bill Drinker.
Yes, Bill Drinker was one of my students, and a very quiet sort of boy. Not as impressive as some of the others at first glance, but he'd done tremendously good work. Yes. Several Opegaard went to DuPont and Baltus, and I don't know who else. Weimar went to Dow. He was a very good student, and he prepared a diphosphine and made complexes of it. And we published a paper on unusual coordinating agents. Of course, diphosphines now are very common. Everybody
yes.
does diphosphine. But in that his time, this was a rare occasion. And Interanti was another of my students who's done very well. Of course, he worked with General Electric for some years. Now he's teaching at Rensselaer. And he tells me he's writing a book on descriptive inorganic chemistry, a textbook.
Uh-huh.
And, Gene LeMay was another one.
Yes.
Very well.
Yes, but I know Gene very well.
Indeed you do. Bob Braisted and Lee Allen Clapp, they both became very prominent in their teaching. They weren't research people particularly, but they both contributed a great deal through their educational activities. Well, Henry Holtzclaw worked jointly with Lightman and me, and of course he's done very well.
Yes.
He's about to retire now. Of course, many of the early ones not only have retired, they've died.
It's a strange feeling, isn't it?
Yeah. Pepard was a good student, did some extremely nice synthetic work with me, and he went to, he moved around a little bit, but spent most of his career at Argonne Laboratory. And,
a fair fraction of these people have gone into academic life.
Yes, about half. And I think, well, I don't know how much influence I had on this. Most of Lou's students, Lou Audrey's students, went into industry. Most of mine went into teaching. Now, whether they chose to go work with Lou because they were interested in the kind of thing he was interested in, or whether he influenced them, I'm not so sure. Same with me. It may be that these students saw that I was enjoyed teaching and liked academic life, and so they thought, well, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, in the choice of problems, too, Lou's, I sat in on Lou's course in non-aqueous solvents, and the, you know, there was so much of an emphasis on industrial applications of these things, and Lou patented quite a bit of material.
Yes.
I recall he had several patents.
That's right.
He was more, I think, oriented toward that approach.
Yes, yes, oh yes, this is true. And whether the students went to him because they felt that or because he influenced them that way, I don't know.
Yeah.
You never know about these things. Yes, half, just almost exactly half of the students have become teachers. They haven't all continued in that. Two or three of them quit chemistry entirely. That always disappoints me a little.
Yeah.
But after all, they have to do what they feel they want to do.
Yes. John, have we neglected to talk about some things that
well,
you think are
Yeah, we might mention a little bit about the conferences on coordination chemistry.
Sure.
I've been very active in that group, although I wasn't in the beginning. The first meeting of that group that I went to was the fifth one, which was in Rome in 1957. And I've been to everyone since then, except two.
They're held every 2 years?
Well, originally they were every 2 years, yes. But 1 year they met in Rome, in London, the same time I was president of the society, which the American Chemistry Society, which was meeting here, so of course I couldn't go to London. I had to be at the ACS meeting. And then a few years later, I was, they met in Paris, or no, in Toulon, Toulouse, in France. And I happened to be sick that time, so I didn't go. But I've been to all the rest. And, yeah, they were supposed to meet every other year. And then the Japanese invited us to come to Japan for a meeting. And the European chemists objected rather strenuously. They said, no, it's too far away. We can't afford to go. And that means that it'll be 4 years between meetings for us. And I... then said, well, look, why can't we just stick their meeting in between the others in the year we would normally meet? And there's no harm if they have a meeting. If you can't go, well, you still go every other year. And so they bought this. Well, it turned out that there were a lot of far distant countries that wanted to have meetings. So what it really has boiled down to since then is that we have met every other year in the western part of the world and the other years in far distant countries. And we're meeting in China this year, you see. Next year it will be in Portugal. And after some years of these meetings in far distant countries, they voted, well, they won't have any more meetings in far distant countries. We've had all the meetings that all the far distant countries have had it. Well, then almost immediately the Chinese showed up and said, well, we want to have a meeting in our country. And so they rescinded the other motion, and so we're meeting in China this next month.
And has the character of those meetings changed much over the years now in terms of...
These meetings, the host organization arranges the meeting. They have complete control. Some of the meetings have been restricted to a certain number of people. Others, they've tried to get as many people as they could. so on and so on. So that it's hard to define what was and what is. Everyone is different.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, yes, they have grown large. And I don't think, it seems to me that there has been no meeting where the number of people was restricted for several years now. But of course, if you have a small meeting, you get more discussion, more crossing of international ties and so on. That on the other hand, if you have a big meeting, more people there, and you spread the word a little further.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the organization is really run, if you call it an organization, it really doesn't have an organization, except they have a permanent secretary, Stan Kirshner, one of my former students. And he doesn't really run the organization. He helps the host organization get things organized and so on. But at each meeting, they have what is sometimes called the advisory committee and sometimes called the executive committee, which meets and plans future meetings. And I've been a member of that executive or advisory committee every year, I guess, since, the first time when I was in Rome. You see, this was only the fifth meeting of the organization, and I met Joe Chack one day, and he said, "Could you have lunch with Selene and Durham and I tomorrow?" And I said, "Well, yeah, sure. What's up?" "Well," we said, "we just wanted to plan the future meetings." And so the four of us had lunch, and we decided where we'd meet the next time.
Mm-hmm.
And this caused some trouble because Madame Chepetowski from Poland had come with an invitation for us to meet in her country. And when she found that we'd already made the decision, didn't even know she had an invitation, she was quite upset about it. So since that time, and because of that, all of the countries represented have been represented at the meeting of the so-called executive committee.
Right.
And this came out at the meeting a year ago. There were some 30 people on the executive committee.
Yeah, quite a large group.
Well, sure. Well, the truth of the matter is that Stan Kirshner organizes things so well that the committee simply okays what he's decided and lets it go with that. And when we met in Boulder several years ago, he had just had a heart attack and had a bypass operation. So I told him, "Stanley, look, you ought to have somebody here as your assistant." "Oh, no, no, no." He said, "I'm all right." "So, well, look, maybe you have an accident. Maybe you have another heart attack or something. Then what?" "Oh, well," he says, "yeah." He says, "I already have somebody in mind." So he asked the boy from Holland. Oh, shoot, you scared out of me. Well, anyway, we now have an assistant,
uh-huh,
permanent secretary, and
he's the heir apparent to Stan's job.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but I don't think he has taken any great part in it so far.
Yeah.
Stan just runs things like a...
Yeah,
he does it very, very well.
Yeah.
And, Stan, I'm very proud of Stan. Oh, another of my students, which I should have mentioned, is having done well, Ron Archer.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm very proud.
You've got a lot of very, very good students.
Yes, I'm very proud of this group of people. And I'm sorry that I don't still have students doing research, graduate students doing research with me. When my second one was elected president of the Chemical Society, Herb Kutowski mentioned to me, "Gee, that's quite a record to have two of your students president decide. And I said, well, yeah, but if I had a chance, I could do it again. And now he just shook his head. But of course, one of my students is now one of the nominees this year, Clayton Callis.
Oh, yes, right.
Of course, Bob Bracid was a nominee. And Alan McClellan was chosen by the Committee on Nominations and Elections. He was not chosen by the council, however. See, the Committee on Nominations and Elections chooses four people, and the council votes on those four and chooses two of them. So I'm hoping that some of the others will get to this exalted position and be president of the society. I think some of them may well.
Well, I see you have on your wall here this family tree of chemists, which shows your legacy or your genealogy back through Lavoisier and so on through Domburg and Baylor. And it's obvious that there will be several, or already are several generations after you.
The
Harry Gray, to other students who are now already doing well.
I sometimes thought if I had time, I would try to assemble a list of the students, of the students, of the students. It's down to the fifth generation now, I know.
The turnover is pretty bad.
The generation, an academic generation, isn't very long.
Yeah.
And there must be hundreds of them. Because C. Basolo and Perry and Bush and Archer and Seavers, they've all had lots of students.
Yeah.
And they've had students, and they've had students. So it goes. I wonder how far my influence runs down into there. I think I've influenced my own students.
Yeah.
Whether that influence has carried on to their students, I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you never can find out.
No, it's hard to know.
Yeah. But it's been a wonderful career. I've had a great time. I think the University of Illinois has been a very fine place for me to work. Of course, I've had numerous opportunities to go elsewhere to be professor or head of department or a dean or something. And Florence used to complain, said, well, look, you don't even think about it. I said, sure, I think about it. I go and visit them, and I decide, no, I don't want it. I said, sure, they've offered me a job that's better than the one I have, at least superficially better, more money, more authority. But I said, in the long run, would I be happier there? And I said, no, this is where I want to be.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
Yeah.
Well, John, we covered a lot of ground on these tapes. Are there some other things that we should touch upon?
Oh, I don't think so.
I think we've covered a very illustrious career, and appreciate very much you taking the time to do it.
Well, I appreciate your taking the time for it, because you're a very busy man. I hope that the people who run this oral history program will find it useful.
I'm sure they will, and thank you again for a very interesting interview, John.
Okay.